You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. You may have noticed that one Whole Foods Market store is not like the other. We're proud that each of our stores has its own quirks, a direct connection to the surrounding community, and buys and sells their own products. Whether it's artisanal chocolates exclusive to Bowery, small batch pickles in Chelsea, or a featured craft beer on tap at West 97th, you'll find that each store is a little bit different than the next. With six Manhattan locations, Whole Foods Market offers a taste of every neighborhood. Come see us in Tribeca, Bowery, Union Square, Chelsea, Columbus Circle, or the Upper West Side. Open 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. For more information, visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Taste Matters on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Isabella Wojcik. I'm the guest host for this beautiful segment, Taste Matters, Wednesdays, 11 to 11:30. Your guest, your host, Mitchell Davis, will be back next week. And as I mentioned, Isabella Wojcik, that's me, and I have two guests in the studio with me that I'm very excited to share this half an hour segment with. Raquel Pelzel, who's a food writer, co-author of great cookbooks, has a fantastic blog I'll ask her to talk about, and just a good around, fantastic, wonderful person to talk with about food and all sorts of matters of taste. And joining us is Chef Ryan Hardy. He is a James Beard Foundation nominee for Great Chef Southwest this year. Most recently, he was at the Little Nell in Aspen, a beautiful Rillian Chateau property. And we're so lucky that he's just ditched Aspen for New York City a few months ago. And he's going to make some great statements here with food in New York City. And we'll talk to him as well. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So Mitchell started off last week, and kind of the topic loosely will relate to taste in some way. The idea being that taste is very important. We spend a lot of time reading, writing, listening to, cooking food, thinking about flavors, looking at beautiful photographs. Not much is really talked about in terms of taste when it comes to these kinds of conversations. So we want to really focus this show on taste in a variety of different ways. And today's topic is going to be taste memory. I think something that everyone has experiences with, whether your palate is extremely clear and your memory is very fond and you can talk about food all day long, or whether you just know you like something or don't like something. I think everyone kind of has shared experiences of taste. Taste memory is this idea that you can remember or recall a particular flavor, dish, concept, and it brings you back not only to the flavor you remember it having, but also the place, the time, the people you were with. And that could be a wonderful experience that's very comforting, but certainly it could be an experience that's so horrifying that you can't even really want to, you know, you don't want to think about it. So we're going to address those issues. So why don't we start? I would love for this to be a conversation. I'll just start by maybe describing one of my taste memories. So I grew up in Poland. I was there till about I was eight. Grew up, you know, not necessarily in a farm setting, but being it was Poland, being it was 30 minutes outside of an urban center, it was already very rural. So we raised our food. There was chickens, there was ducks, wow. Orchards, mm-hmm. Gardens. I think flavors that I took for granted until I came to the U.S. and I was in the suburbs of Long Island, and lots of things were new, and new packaged flavors were new to me and very exciting. But I think I started to develop an appreciation for where I had come from. So a funny little memory is Sunday supper, my grandmother would kill a chicken, we'd cook it and eat all the different parts and use the stock left that was left over for soup for the next day. And I remember hanging around because the gizzard was that most coveted part, and I just hoped to get the gizzard. So when I think about that, it makes me feel like a little kid. It reminds me of standing in that kitchen, that chicken pot, chicken soup boiling, and looking for for that little gizzard to bob up to know that it's still in there. Like, my grandmother saved it for me and I'm going to get it. So that's my own little special treasure amazing. Of a memory.
I
love that.
Now I know what to get you for Christmas.
A live chicken. <Yeah.
laughs> Or just a pound of gizzards. Gizzards.
Big bow.
So Raquel, let's start with you. I mean, you're a food writer. You speak so beautifully in our friendship about food. Maybe tell us a little bit about some great memories, or what is that idea?
Sure. For me, I think whenever I think about how I learned about food, I go back to being a kid, as a lot of us do. And I used to go out for dinner with my parents divorced when I was very young. And I used to go out for dinner with my dad every Friday night. And we would go to a different restaurant, sometimes Cuban. You know, I grew up in Chicago, so there's a lot of different ethnic cuisines to try out. You know, we'd do Cuban, we'd do Pakistani goat curry, we would do the Israeli restaurant, we would go to a Greek fish place. And every week he would just start telling me stories about how he grew up on this kibbutz in Israel, and about all the wonderful foods that he would eat and make and cook. And I think that's where my love of kind of connecting the taste of whatever we were eating at the table, which maybe had nothing to do with what he was talking about, but making those connections between my dad's taste memories, what I was eating, and then the stories behind these beautiful experiences. And, you know, I collaborate on a lot of cookbooks, and that's really the true goal of a great cookbook, is to kind of reach into the chef or their food personality's memory and try to make these connections between whatever the recipe is and kind of some recollection or flavor or experience they may have had. And that's kind of what people can connect with. And it's what kind of makes food very three-dimensional, I think.
Yeah. I love that thought. And I think, just to kind of add on to that, I think that, you know, as a chef, but anybody in the food business really understands that food is a cultural anthropology. And I think that really starts at a very young age. I think that food memories are just like any kind of memories, but they're really most influential when you're like 8 to 12 years mm-hmm. old, I feel like. And so, you know, whatever influences you have during that part of your life tend to stick with you. And I think you're right. I think the best restaurants also try and bring that forward and give you an experience. It's not about just taste and service, but also a peek inside the passion of, you know, whoever the captain is or whoever the chef is or, you know, whatever that cuisine is, you know, as you progress through a meal. And that's really hard to do, but it's something that I think all of us long for as we eat. You know, we want that one tiny memory that we remember, you know, from way back when, which is really special.
So James Beard wrote about in Pride and Prejudice. He wrote about, sorry, Delights and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice. I think the same author. Yeah.
He talked about taste memory. And for him, certainly the Pacific Northwest, where he had grown up, and the idea of the spectacular Dungeness crabs and shellfish and salmon and all of this. He also talked about the idea that not all taste memory is accurate. So sometimes what you're remembering in your mind and you're recalling, if you were to go back and have it, you know, again, it just would be very disappointing. And in some ways, it lives better as the memory. So do you have any experiences like that where it's just, you know, you tell that story, you reminisce, you probably embellish as time goes on in the retelling, but should you sit down to that whatever oatmeal, you know, or whatever that dish is, it's just not going to be the same. So it's probably best not to even be able to revisit. Anything comes to mind like that?
I think, you know, I can't pinpoint one particular thing. Well, I guess maybe probably my favorite food in the world is peach. Like, this time of the year is my favorite time of the year. And
why is that? Is that because of where you're from, or just...
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Kentucky. There's not a whole lot of peaches that are grown there. And every year, my family would pack us into the car. I was the youngest of five kids, so there were, you know, seven of us driving, you know, across a couple of states to get to the ocean. We'd go to North Carolina, South Carolina. And the peaches from Georgia, South Carolina are just unbelievable. And Georgia is where I'm from, so there was this kind of, like, you know, nostalgia there that I had because I was the one that was born in Atlanta, you know, et cetera. And every year we would stop by the side of the road. I mean, back then, to get to this beach, it was a two-lane highway. And so we'd stop, you know, on these dusty roads and pick up a bushel of peaches. And we'd eat half the bushel in the car. We'd be covered in this sweet nectar, you know, as we got to the beach. And we could barely wait to pick these up. And then we'd pick more up on the way home. And my mom was so passionate about these things. She couldn't wait to go to the ocean, not only to have great seafood, but also to have these peaches. And so I remember those as a kid, And when I moved to Colorado, they told me, oh, these are some of the best peaches in the country. And I said, you know, you guys are crazy. You're nuts. The best peaches come from down there. And I was really surprised because they were amazing. And then when I went back and had a peach in South Carolina, you know, I thought, you know, they're very, very good. They're just as good as the ones in Colorado. So you're right, I guess.
All right. My experience is something I've been going to California to visit some friends, and of course a trip to California means an In-N-Out burger. I mean, it just does. It's linked for me. And I almost can't go anywhere west of the Mississippi. And if I think there's an In-N-Out, I have to go. I don't care if I'm not even hungry. It just is a compulsion at this point. And I'm recalling that the first time I had it, it was just such a marvelous experience with friends. I was overjoyed at the existence of such, you know, quick, interesting, delicious, yummy, fast cheeseburger-ness. And I was swept away and charmed by the whole concept, the whole design, the whole aesthetic. Certainly service is such a big part of what makes an experience special for me. So the service of it, everything was magical. And it just lives in my brain, that first experience. And I've been going so many times, and even in Las Vegas, you know, where I had to take a limousine to get there. And,
wow.
And it seems like every time I go, it's just less as good as that memory. And I keep, I don't know why, I feel like one of these days I'm going to just have to pass by an In-N-Out and not even go in. And I
maybe it was the limo.
But that's just one example of, you know, I feel like these memories and the idea of what they mean to us. I mean, it's comfort. I think part of it is, like I mentioned before, I mean, it's who you're with, it's the surroundings, maybe it's what you're on your way to doing or what else you eat or just that time. And I think, you know, it just you want to go back to that time. And sure. I feel mm-hmm. like you hold on to that emotion.
Well, taste can be so experiential. It's so connected to that moment in time when you experienced whatever you were eating. My great-grandmother growing up used to make the most incredible pumpkin pie. It's legend in the family. Like, no one's pumpkin pie will ever come close to Nana's, no matter how many times you try to recreate
it. It's
over
for you.
Oh, yeah. There's no, you know, I could be making pies that are better, but everyone's in, it's, you know, not Nana's. It's not from her hands. It's not something that came from her kitchen. Who knows what, she probably used canned pumpkin pie mix and some condensed milk. And I mean, who knows? But, the recipe was never written down, and it's something that only exists, you know, in our memories and of holidays and getting together, and now the recipe's gone. And, you know, it can be kind of a little tragic too, I think, taste memories, when you can't recreate it, and it's a longing. And maybe it's what, you know, as I develop a lot of recipes, and maybe it's what kind of keeps you going to find that perfect whatever, that sure. perfect thing that you have in your head that maybe you'll never get to, and maybe it'll be a lifelong quest
for
the perfect pumpkin pie or biscuit or pancake or fried chicken, you know.
But I think life is that way. I mean, that we always move forward. We can't go back and be 15 years old again, or, you know, 12 years old again and playing baseball. Whatever it is, you have to move forward. And so you have these memories, and you recreate them in a different way. I think that's kind of cool. You have to come up with a new pumpkin pie.
Well, the other thing too is, I mean, think about before technology, there was the idea of storytelling and stories and sitting around and
folk
sharing
music.
Eating folk music. So I feel like, you know, in some ways, maybe, you know, that pumpkin pie does taste better in the story, and let it be the legend. I mean, it connects you to her, it mm-hmm. connects you to her kitchen, it connects you to your family, and it transcends that. You know, that pumpkin pie serves as a role, but it's no longer this thing, you know, mm-hmm. this edible object. I wanted to remind everyone, you're listening to Taste Matters, Wednesdays from 11 to 11:30. I'm your guest host today, Isabella. HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Certainly you can check us out in archive, but on Wednesdays from 11 to 11:30, it's live. And if you're interested and have an experience you want to share, you can call in right now. 718-497-2128 is the phone number. So let's talk about the idea of maybe what comforts us and how different that is maybe from country to country or region to region, because I just love talking about food with friends, and when, you know, when the thing that is your thing that wraps you in comfort is something I would never want to eat, wouldn't comfort me at all, you know, and And conversely, I mean, being from Poland, I mean, I feel like tripe and blood sausage and homemade sausages and kielbasa and sandwiches are the thing that I just, if I'm very stressed out, an open face sandwich looking at me is the thing that just calms me down. And what's even funnier is, you know, my husband, who is very American and as lovely as is, can't really understand how anyone would want a sandwich first thing in the morning. And when my mom spent the night, you know, I could see he was sort of going to offer her cereal or oatmeal, and there's yogurt, and she just went straight for the open face ham sandwich. You know? So that's my own experience. But let's talk about maybe the I mean, any funny stories about, you know, just what comforts other people that you know, or what's comforting to you besides peaches.
You know, when I was younger, we had to feed a lot of kids, and we had a big garden. My parents got together when I was very young. I think I was probably 6 or 7, and decided they were going to put in a big garden plot, and it was way bigger than our family needed. So we were constantly giving away zucchini and tomatoes to our neighbors, but we had, I think they really designed it to be slave labor for us, for discipline. But the greatest things that came out of there are some of the taste memories that I still love today. And for me, being an Italian cook, I've kind of adapted those memories into my repertoire of Italian food. But I think that probably my favorite is risotto. And growing up and taking the flowers off of the zucchini plants and kind of eating them and not understanding what they were, my grandmother would kind of pull them off and kind of explain what they were. Oh, they're edible, you know, et cetera. And, you know, I transferred that. And I remember going to this place in Rome. One of my favorite restaurants is a little place called Costanza. And it's in this old theater. The legend has it that this is where Mark Antony, you know, kind of dealt Caesar his fateful bow. But they make this risotto al fiore di zucca that is... It's lights out. I mean, it's unbelievable, and it's one of those things that for me, when it's a late fall kind of you know, time, or if it's early spring, it's still kind of, you know, chilly in the air, and you can get those kind of things. Just a risotto for me is like there's something that's the passion lies in the half an hour that it takes from start to finish. You can't walk away from it. You can't pick up your phone. You can't pick up the TV or any of that stuff. It has to be off. You can't take a break. So, for me, it's about that moment of shutting everything off and kind of wrapping yourself in this warm rice dish that I think is really amazing.
And Raquel, we'll get to you in a moment, but I just wanted to take a brief pause at this time, and we'll be back shortly.
There's a freeway where we played football in the field. Apartments on the pictured Highbury. There's a shed called Deer Creek, of which my one critique is there's no creek now and it's all deer free. There's a Walgreens where there were no walls, just greenery. There's a theme park in a palace in Tennessee. That tree there is a pylon, but some things you can rely on. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a hard luck story everywhere you look.
Yay, and we're back. So hi, everyone. Again, it's your guest host for this segment of Taste Matters, Isabella Wojcik. I'm here with two of my great guests, Raquel Pelzel, great food writer, and Chef Ryan Hardy. Welcome both to the show. We're live till 11:30, and then you can catch Mitchell Davis back next week, and we're talking about Taste Matters. And we have a caller. We're so excited. It's a surprise, so let's find out. Hello? Are you there?
Hi, this is Jordana Rothman. I'm the food editor at Time Out New York.
Hi, Jordana.
Hi, Jordana. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi, everyone. So, yeah, Raquel, I just wanted to call in and talk about some taste memories. I know you guys were looking for some stories about some great taste memories, and I actually wanted to share one that's not my own but taught me a lot about taste memories, actually one of my mother's. Are you guys up for that?
Yeah,
absolutely. Who doesn't love a mother story?
So this actually took place when I was very young. I think I was around 7 or 8 years old, and we were visiting my brother for like a sort of parents' day at a camp in upstate New York, or actually maybe in Pennsylvania. And, you know, we're visiting this campground, and my mother realizes that, you know, it's under new ownership, but it happens to be the campground where she worked for like many, many years as a lifeguard when she was young, and she had all these like wonderful memories working there, and we're like walking around the grounds, and she's like so excited to be there. And so we go into town, and she's telling us all these stories about how she used to go into town and like do her laundry and go out with the girls in the 60s, and, you know, it was a great time for me to kind of hear a little bit about what my mother was like during that time. So she's telling me this story about this lemonade that she used to go get, and she was just waxing so beautifully poetic about this lemonade. It was like the perfect balance of sour and sweet. It was like the most flawless lemonade ever made. So we're walking around, and we see this shop, and the shop is still there, and it's still selling the lemonade. And I got so excited because I wanted to go in and, first of all, taste the lemonade and have my mother taste it and just be there with her and sort of, like, relive this time before I was even, like, a sparkle in her eye, you know? And she just refused to go in and taste it.
Oh, no.
Something's better left unsaid.
Exactly. So she, you know, she's this incredibly wise woman, you know, and I didn't realize it at the time. At the time, I was, like, hugely frustrated and stomped my feet and everything. But she just has this incredible wisdom because she understood that sometimes, you know, aww, it's not about the flavor. It's about the sort of memory of it. And that, you know, sometimes the sort of, you know, it would never taste as good, you know, right, yeah, now as it would taste in sort of her mind's eye, and she just wouldn't taste it. And I, you know, in my later years have come to sort of accept that as an early life lesson.
Yeah.
I call tasting the lemonade, you know, these periods
so
in your
lovely
life that, you know, you can't necessarily go back to, but are nonetheless very special. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was like country time or something.
Maybe it is now. I don't know. It could have been then, you know. Sometimes it's not really about like how it's made. It's about, you know, your experience with it.
Totally.
So. Well, Jordan, I wanted to thank you, and I hope you don't mind if I just adopt your story as my own.
That's
this
a great one.
Little philosophical nugget, tasting the lemonade.
My mother will love it. Go for it.
You know, I had such a, and you're reminding me, I mean, I had such a disillusioning experience because my own grandmother, to speak to Raquel's experience with the epic pumpkin pie, I grew up mostly with my grandmother, and my mom would come every day to be with me, but it was really my grandmother who lived in that house, and we lived through her food, and she nourished us all. And I think I just adopted my love of cooking from her. What I presumed was tireless passion, and I could probably write a love poem to my grandmother. But in having revisited so many years and having gone back to Poland so many years, at some point I realized she's not a good cook at all. And I think I was staving off that realization, you know, as much as possible. And one day, as probably like, you know, early college years or late high school, it just dawned on me, like, she's really not a good cook.
That's so
she's
funny.
Proficient, as women of her era were. You feed your family, this, you know, you grow it and then you cook it. But she resented the task. She was from World War II era, so if you didn't have to put it in, like, salt was optional, you know, flavor was optional. If you didn't have to put it in, you didn't need to. So I grew up with this wonderful homemade food in my mind, but then I started to realize, but my mother is a phenomenal cook. So I wonder where she got her lessons from.
Yeah.
And then I realized my mother doesn't even like to cook. So I feel like I'm finally like third generation, and not only do I like to cook, but I'm a pretty good one too.
That's funny.
But the disappointment was just, I can't get over that one. And it's your grandmother. I mean, you can't think ill of your grandmother's cooking, you know.
Of course not.
Raquel, you mentioned you were going to tell us about maybe taste memory that you didn't have.
Well, you know, as a kid, I remember so vividly being homesick from school. And the best part of being sick from school was that you got to watch TV like all day, especially if you were, you know, a latchkey kid like I was. So I was there parked in front of the television watching some show in black and white. I have no idea what it was, but it was old and in black and white. And I remember this chocolate cake on a platter with one of those domed covers. And this woman with the perfectly set hair and like a kitchen apron, you know, the kids came home from school and she said, "Look, here's chocolate cake." And it was like, I so wanted that chocolate cake. And like, to this day, no chocolate cake has ever lived up to that taste memory, even though I never tasted it.
Right.
But it was like some kind of ideal of how perfect of a world this is, where you come home from school to a giant slab of chocolate cake.
I could go for one of those right now.
I know. Yeah. It's approaching 11:30, but who cares? It's chocolate cake time. Somewhere it's chocolate cake time. I do believe we might have another caller. No. Am I just making that up? We don't have another caller. All right. Well, you have
we have
probably,
a taste memory
is
of
a taste memory.
We're imagining someone calling, and this is what they might talk about.
Right?
But I want to remind everyone, you have about 6 more minutes to call us right now at 718-497-2128, and it's heritageradionetwork.com.
It's not a telethon. You don't have to donate.
But we do want to stick to the topic of taste, so please don't call with any other ideas. And let's talk about taste memories and that fear of food or fear of consuming something or experiencing something because it was so atrocious the first time around. I mean, I feel like because they're so sensationalistic, those are the stories you hear about from people, especially if they're not food writers or in the food business and used to talking about food all the time. So it's that, like, I will never eat this again because. So I'm wondering if you have any experiences like that, and for you yourself, I mean, you're both food professionals, so perhaps you've had to, you know, overcome that hurdle, and now you eat and drink and taste everything. But is there anything that you recall was just like such a bad experience, but you have gone on to consume it again, or if you heard of a story of someone who just won't eat X because just can't do it? And I don't want to put you on the spot.
No. You know, I think a couple. I mean, I think there's obvious ones. I mean, a fall is always a tough one for people. I think, you know, for me, I think the first time I had tripe was probably in Paris, 12 years ago, something like that, 10 years ago. And it wasn't, I had to force myself through it, you know, kind of thing, where I was like, I need to like this kind of thing. And it really wasn't good. I mean, it was terrible. And now tripe is one of my favorite things to cook. I really love it.
Funny.
But I've had to figure out a way to make it so that it, you know, pardon me, but so that it tasted good. I love you, France. But the Italians are better cookers. Tripa. Anyway, so that was something that was really like a challenge to get through. But I think a fall is like an easy one. You know, when I was a kid, I remember not liking tomatoes. I hated the idea of a tomato. And I have this great memory of my mother used to go out in the garden with her apron on, and she'd have a salt shaker in the pocket of her apron. And she would go out and she would take tomatoes, and like part of her weeding, like her guilty pleasure was to take a tomato right off the vine and take a bite and sprinkle salt on it and just eat the whole thing. I thought that was the grossest thing ever. You know, I thought it was just disgusting. And then I, you know, later on, now the tomato is, you know, it's one of the greatest things on earth. But so I don't know. That's kind of a strange one. But
what an epicure to already be out there in the field with the salt shaker.
I know. She's amazing. She's a terrific woman.
I had this experience. I had a near drowning experience as a kid.
That's way worse than mine.
With lots of salt water. My head was pushed in the sand. Like, just not a great memory. I was in Spain, in Madrid, a few years ago at this very, you know, fancy pants restaurant, like had a lab, and it probably has a very fancy name that I'm not remembering. I'm sure a very famous chef that I'm not remembering. But what I remember is that we were served sea urchin, and it brought me right back to that beach. I was probably like 2 or 3. I was really, who knows how old, but to this day, like, I have trouble with sea urchin because it brings back death. You know, if I can get over that, then maybe I will be, like, you know, more at peace with life.
You know, it's funny that you say sea urchin because for some reason our maiden show was last week and I talked about this craving for sea urchin that I was having.
Oh, I love urchin.
But I had an experience of not really liking lamb and goat things. And this was before lamb and goat was, especially goat, was really popular. And I was in college. I went to Cornell and there was a chef there, Danio, who still has a restaurant in the area. Danio's on Seneca Lake, but this was in Ithaca. And senior year, I ordered a pasta, and I know it was like a medley of items, including fresh goat cheese. And I just knew I just didn't want goat cheese because it was going to be like lamby and goaty, and I just wasn't really into that, not having had that much exposure. But and I figured it's a thing you can just leave off the pasta. So out came the chef with a whole big goat cheese tasting. And that's the first time I ever met him. Was he came out. He couldn't believe a customer wanted to change his dish and wouldn't appreciate, you know, the freshness and the beauty of these cheeses that he had gone to the trouble of procuring. And he was going to make me taste them and enjoy them or else, kind of thing, but in a really charming sort of way. And of course,
and did you like them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was
I love it.
I was stunned both in the audacity of him. I mean, I was 20. What was I going to say? You know, but it opened my mind. So it was just a really funny situation of experiencing something. And the, I think his passion and his just his eagerness to share that with me. I mean, I think if someone had just said, taste this, I may not have liked it as much, you know, as that experience.
Isn't it amazing how like contagious passion can be in food? That if you can just transfer that to somebody, then they tend to like things. It's amazing. Chicken liver is one of those things I think that you can get people to like if they'll just try it.
Right.
Oh, I love chicken liver.
Me too.
Or tripe, but maybe that's the next, maybe that's the next segment.
Right.
Well, thank you to both of you. I mean, I feel like we're very much close to the end. I wanted to remind everyone, you're listening to Taste Matters. Your regular host, Mitchell Davis, will be back next week. Periodically, you'll hear from Isabella as well. We're on heritageradionetwork.com. Look for the show in archives. And my guests today were two fabulous speakers. So thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
And Raquel, good luck with the new book.
So hold on, Raquel.
Sorry.
Raquel Pelzel, and I forgot to mention, of all the books that she has co-written, she's also a James Beard Foundation nominee. And Raquel, tell us the name of your blog where we can find you.
It's rockinthekitchen.com, R-A-Q, in the kitchen. Yeah.
All right, we'll look for you there. And Chef Ryan Hardy, thank you again. You're a JBF nominee. You're at the Little Nell. You're at Rubicon. You've cooked all over. You're a Kentuckian.
I know.
Now you're a New Yorker. And we look forward to reading your name in print.
Thank you. Look for a new restaurant.
Well, we look forward to dining and having new taste memories being made and brought by you. But tell us where we can follow you now.
Thank you. You know, I'm on Twitter. You can look for me at Face Sausage. a good memory to remember. At Face Sausage on Twitter. And look for a new restaurant coming soon.
Cool.
Yeah.
So thank you to both of you. Thank you, listeners. Yes.
A quick shout out. Thank you to John Wesley Harding for his great song, Starbucks, where the Starbucks used to be.
Love that.
That was the intermezzo. And have a great day, everyone. And we'll see you at Taste Matters again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. 14 family farms and over 50 restaurants have committed to participation in No Goat Left Behind, a new program developed by Heritage Foods USA, a meat distribution company dedicated to preserving endangered breeds. Without an end market, the majority of male dairy goats are sold into the commodity market or killed at birth. Dairy farmers are always struggling with feed prices, milk prices, and weather. Goats usually have twins or triplets, and for every female who will become a milker, there is a male buckling who will become a financial drain. It makes no sense that these males are sold into the commodity market or put to death when the United States imports almost 50% of its annual goat supply. Home consumers interested in participating can order goats through heritagefoodsusa.com. They will receive goats via FedEx, and home delivery is available for New York City customers. In addition to the goat, these packages will also include recipes and a DVD featuring interviews with the farmers, processors, and chefs demonstrating how to break down and cook goat. Again, for more information on No Goat Left Behind, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com or call Aaron Fairbanks at 718-389-0985. This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today. The following message is from Bubby's. Bubby's Main Street is thrilled to announce a fall program of special dinners celebrating efforts to renovate American agriculture and the American menu. Each event will feature a conversation with persons who are deeply involved in a significant aspect of this project, followed by a meal that illustrates materially and pleasurably the themes under discussion. From our perspective at Bubby's, we observe and participate in three parallel movements that are gaining momentum in the New York region and around the country. New farmers supplying green markets and alternative food networks with produce and animals raised without relying on an arsenal of chemicals or industrial methods. New artisans reinventing food crafts. And a fresh appreciation of authentic American cooking from all regions and communities. For more information about these events, visit Bubby's.com. That's B-U-B-B-Y-S.com. Or contact Danny Finkel directly at 646-338-0422.